We begin in the time of King Herod, a time of deep injustice and ordinary suffering, the kind that settles in and sadly becomes background noise. Herod was the most dangerous kind of powerful person. He was an insecure one, afraid of losing his place, his privilege, his comfort. Fear like that consumes a person. It demands constant vigilance, constant control. And the truth is, Herod was not a real king at all. He was a client ruler, a collaborator, a carefully managed instrument of the Roman Empire, that vast, brutal machine built on extraction, violence, and the myth of order. So you can imagine the jolt of terror when a small delegation of scholars from the East arrived at his palace, camels outside, treasure in hand, and asked Herod of all people, for directions to the king of the Jews. Herod is sick. These magi, wise and well studied as they were, did not have all the answers. Wisdom, it turns out, does not eliminate the need for help. They had left their homeland, their security, their familiarity to follow a hope they could not yet name. Their guide was a star, a breathtaking natural sign that led them most of the way, but not all the way. Because signs can point, but they cannot decide for us when to stop looking. If you're searching for a king, common sense takes you to the palace. That's where power lies. That's where decisions are made. That's where history seems to turn. Along with the star, the Magi carried logic. They carried learning. They carried a working knowledge of sacred texts. It's not hard to imagine that these Eastern intellectuals would have read Israel's prophets. So they come to Jerusalem bearing gold and frankincense and myrrh, embodying Isaiah's old dream of nations streaming toward light, toward a city crowned with a throne and a temple. And there, with a kind of tragic innocence, they turn to Herod, that poor, anxious, violent, lesser king, for directions to the real king. Herod responds as fearful power always does when confronted with genuine hope. A baby born for the healing of the world is for him an existential threat. So he consults the religious establishment, the scribes, the scholars who are fluent in scripture and accustomed to proximity to power. They search the text, but they do not find the triumphant vision of Jerusalem's future glory. Instead, they find something dangerous, something destabilizing. In the prophet Micah, in the old stories of Samuel, they discover that God's anointed ruler will not emerge from the center, but from the edges. Not from a palace, but from a village. Not from prominence, but from obscurity. Bethlehem, small, unimpressive, still, easily overlooked. Walter Brueggemann reminds us that the Magi were only off by 9 miles. It's just 9 miles from the Temple Mount to Bethlehem. But what a long mile, 9 miles it was, from where power imagines God to be to where God actually is, working quietly on the margins, on the edges. This story, Brueggemann says, is really about two places, Jerusalem and Bethlehem. One represents the illusion of security, self-sufficiency, control, normality, the belief that safety can be purchased or enforced or defended with walls and weapons. We know how seductive that vision can be. We live inside of it in America today. The other place tells a different story, a fragile story, a subversive story. It's the ancient dream that runs through all scripture of swords beaten into plowshares, of neighbors no longer trained for war, of creation restored to God's original intention. Without the death of innocence, without state-sanctioned violence, a world without wretched injustice. The way of Jesus, echoing Micah, is vulnerability, neighborliness, generosity, and the refusal to learn war anymore. Well, if you read the paper this morning, we're not there yet. The powerful still cling to money and dominance and fear, and millions still live one day at a time, hoping for enough food, for enough water, and just maybe a night without violence. That's why this Epiphany story matters. Journeys are taken, conversations are held, scripture is opened, hearts are revealed, some in worship, some in terror. At the center of it all, there's a still, immovable point. It's a baby in a manger. We have seen so many signs already. Angels, shepherds, stars, dreams. We often think of Epiphany as the season when God reveals God's self to us. But what if this is a season, also a moment when God is watching us? What if God is looking for a sign, not in the sky, but in the life of the church, in the life of this parish, in your and my lives? What will God see? Fear or courage? Self-protection or generosity? Despair or hope? This is the journey that's before us, to examine how our own lives and our life together might become a reflection of love made flesh, of hope practiced daily, of compassion enacted, of generosity chosen. All of it, traced back to that small, stubborn, radiant truth that God chose not the palace, but the manger.